Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Trishul and Aaron try to introduce all the nuance and complexity behind estate planning. They explain how the step-up in basis on taxable accounts can be better for heirs than inheriting a traditional IRA. They then discuss wills and trusts, both revocable and irrevocable. Then there are community property states versus separate property states. Don't forget the estate tax exemption, the annual gift tax exemption, and the lifetime gift tax exemption. Yikes. There are so many little caveats that there is no universal estate planning recommendation. Other than you need to plan ahead, because it'll be too late after you pass away. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area. I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
Great to be here as well. So last week, we were talking about taxable investment accounts and comparing those to IRAs, both traditional IRAs and Roth IRAs. And one of the things we didn't really touch upon is one of the benefits of a taxable investment account over a traditional IRA specifically comes up in estate planning. When you own a stock and the stock grows, you don't pay taxes on that gain until you sell it. And if you happen to pass away, your heirs, your beneficiaries, get a step up in basis. Means that the whatever that unrealized gain was that you never paid, they don't have to pay either. Their basis steps up to the day you die. So if they sell it immediately, the heirs don't owe any capital gains taxes. But with a traditional IRA, the IRS considered that money was always pre-tax. So when you pass away, your heirs or beneficiaries need to still pay taxes on that money. Either they take it as a lump sum, it adds to the ordinary income, or you can do something like an inherited IRA. And what used to be a lifetime schedule, you now have to take it out within 10 years. So you have to take all the money, the heirs or beneficiaries have to take all the money out of the traditional IRA and pay taxes on that within 10 years. So that was just one of the benefits of a taxable investment account over a traditional IRA. And today we will go into other estate planning strategies and estate planning concepts that might come up, that things to be just be aware of, things to look out for, and looking at different strategies that could help you for estate planning purposes. So Trishul, when you're having an estate planning conversation with clients, what are some of the first high-level topics that you talk to them about?
Thanks, Aaron. And I'd also like to dig into some of those tax points as well. But yeah, at a high level, let's begin the conversation with just thinking about what do we discuss initially when we talk about estate planning with a client. To begin, I'd just like to give clients an idea of what is it all about? What's the point of estate planning? And to put it simply, the goal is to just provide a client with confidence that their future and that their loved ones will be taken care of once they pass away. And there are a variety of things to think about, but the main things are basically you want to ensure that you provide support and some financial stability for your spouse. You also want to preserve your assets for future generations if that's a priority for you. And this is also an opportunity to maybe consider providing to charity or sponsoring a worthy cause. And then the goal is also to make sure that your assets get passed to people that you care about in the way that you want them to be passed. Meaning if you have certain assets that you want to go to somebody in particular, you want to make sure those ideas are followed. And then, you know, what we're going to dig into in this conversation is the notion that you want to also keep your tax burden under control, and you want to minimize the expenses along the way. So those are things that we'll dig into as well. And finally, there are some important things to think about when it comes to estate planning in terms of what if you become incapacitated. And that's where an estate plan can help, either if you're not able to make financial decisions or even decisions regarding your health. An estate plan can help you with these sorts of things. So that's kind of how I'd like to kick off the conversation, just with a high level notion of what is this whole process about?
Okay, so maybe would you like to describe a scenario where maybe you yourself are married, you have children, you have assets and properties? What would be an appropriate thing to think about in terms of estate planning for you at this age? And then we'll have another conversation about, say, children out of the house, they're maybe close to retirement, and now they are going to pass away sooner. So for you, estate planning would be kind of an accidental death or an else, but it's kind of an untimely passing. It feels sometimes a little bit morbid to say that any passing is not untimely. But for you, at your age, what are the relevant factors of estate planning? And then we'll get into later in life when children grow, maybe grandchildren in the picture. So for you, what's your estate plan look like?
Right. So from my perspective, I have a child who is a minor. So that's something I need to think about. And the way that this comes into the picture is if you have not done an estate plan, and if you have really nothing in place, or if you just have something simple and not something robust, your minor children can get tied up in quite a bit of a mess in terms of, first of all, who takes care of your children after you pass away? Let's say myself and my wife end up in a car crash or something. Well, you know, what happens to my child? And then also, what happens to my assets? I can't hand my child, you know, a car and say, figure out what to do with it. She's two. So there are a lot of things to think about with this respect, especially if you have a minor child. And that's where this distinction comes in that I'd like to make between what you've probably heard when it comes to an estate plan in terms of having a will, and then what actually might make sense for an individual like myself, which is to have something known as a trust. So let me make that distinction about the difference between a will and a trust. I'm sure many people have heard of a will. It's also known as a last will and testament. And it's a legal document which basically outlines your wishes of what to happen with your assets. Basically, everything you have is known as your estate, and what happens to that estate after passing. But there are many problems with a will. It doesn't go as far as most people will need it to, and that's where this notion of a trust comes into play. Now, a trust is also a set of legal documents, but beyond a will, it has a bunch of benefits that I'd like to dig into. So the main benefit of a trust is if you don't have a trust, basically what happens is your assets end up in a pretty lengthy and arduous process with the court system known as probate. And the courts will try to decipher the will or non-will that you have and try to figure out what to do with your assets. And not having a trust makes this process cumbersome because it can be costly and it can take time, sometimes even years, before your situation gets sorted out with your estate. While at the same time, you know, bills could not be paid and assets can be not taken care of and things like that. So it can definitely turn into a mess. But if you have a set of documents known as a trust, well, you can avoid this process. And also for the situation that I mentioned with my minor child, the trust can specify a few important things. It can spell out what to do with my minor child in the case that my wife and I become incapacitated or unable to live, and the child can go to who we designate. And the other thing is the assets can also be distributed to that child when the child becomes an adult. And we can even specify in a trust, for example, that a certain percentage of the assets get passed on to the child at different checkpoints that are age-based. So again, this is just a lot more flexibility that you probably want to have if you're in a situation like myself.
So if there's a will, then all the assets still go through probate and the courts will try to interpret the will and they'll assign a guardian for your daughter. They'll then assign an executor saying, here are the instructions that you need to follow to kind of take care of the money. Because again, your minor daughter can't be in charge of the financial assets. Does that sound right?
Yeah. So basically the courts will appoint something known as a conservator. And this is not somebody of your choosing. It's who the courts choose based upon whoever they decide based upon their set of rules. And they'll figure out what to do. And of course, this might not be anything that you want to happen.
That's a good point. So this is a small legal distinction. Conservator would take care of determining what it is for the minor children. If there are no minor children, it's just assets. I believe it's an executor. Or it could be different state by state, now that I think about it. But they're more or less the same.
Right. And the high-level point is you probably don't want the courts figuring out what to do with your child and your assets. You probably have some idea of how to handle your estate in a sensible way. And that's the main benefit of a trust, making sure that whatever you think makes sense is spelled out ahead of time.
Okay, so you get a trust set up and it has all the instructions that you want, who is going to be taking care of your daughter, who's going to be taking care of the money. One thing I like to point out, clients, is that those don't necessarily need to be the same person. If there's someone in your life who you think would be a great parent or godparent, but you're not quite as confident that they would be able to handle your assets, you can choose someone else to handle the financial assets, but maybe they're not quite as warm and not quite as loving to young children. So those can be different people. So you get that set up and you have all your assets in the trust. And what are some other things that you think about after the trust when it comes to having a spouse and minor children?
So we trust that there are many flavors, but basically two main categories of trust that we want to think about. The first is a revocable trust, and the second is a irrevocable trust. And the difference is basically the revocable trust can be revoked or changed, and the irrevocable trust cannot. And why does this make sense? Well, it comes down to a few concerns, mainly to do with taxes, which we'll get into a bit later. But the notion is that with a revocable trust, you maintain control of what goes on in the trust and the rules and how things are dispersed and who gets what and so on. And there are certain reasons why this makes sense. The main reason is you get to maintain control of your trust.
So life happens, things change. You want to change the financial control, change the trustees.
Right. You have a kid.
Your kids grow up. Oh, yeah. You have another kid. Get divorced. Yeah. Life changes. You want to be able to make the change to your estate planning documents as well.
Right. Then there's the irrevocable trust where you can't edit it. It just, you figure out the rules and the rules have to be followed. And once the trust is created, the moment it's signed, even though you're still alive, the trust is out of your control. It's passed on to whoever the trust is assigned to take care of that set of assets. Now, why would you do that? Why would you say, I want a trust where once I sign it, I don't have access to how that trust moves forward in terms of any changes? And that basically comes down to this notion of estate tax. So when you have an estate and it passes on to your heirs, it is subject to an estate tax if the amount of assets within that estate is above a certain exemption threshold. And that threshold used to be low, and it's actually something that has climbed a lot in recent years. Now it's actually 11.58 million for somebody who's single, or for a couple, you can double that through a procedure called portability to around 23 million. Meaning if your estate is smaller than those cutoffs, you actually don't have to worry about estate tax. And if you're nearing those cutoffs, you can do some things to figure out what to do about estate tax. But if you're nowhere near those cutoffs, estate tax won't be a big issue for now.
One thing we want to kind of quickly address is that the exemption does change over time and is controlled by acts of Congress. So originally, I think over the last 20 years, in 1997, it was $600,000. By about 2002, it was up to $1 million. And so if it didn't change, it's relatively easy to get to an estate once you include your primary residence over that. They tried to work on increasing it to $2 million, then to $5 million, and adjusting that for inflation. And 2018, it went up to just over $11 million, and due to inflation adjustments now, 11.58. But Congress could reduce this number. It does not necessarily only have to go up. And that's one of the reasons why you want to at least be aware of what the exemption is. There are certain corners of the internet that might believe that if Democrats are in control of the presidency and both the Senate and the House of Representatives, they might want to bring the estate tax number back down to $2 or $3 million. And so now that does come back into play. So as of right now, unlikely to be a concern. And most people felt that the number was too low, that it was affecting too many households, that it was not really designed to affect. But just be aware that that number can change in the future.
Right. What you want to think about if, let's say, you're easily over that number today even, well, there's ways to carve out your assets and remove them from your estate and put them in a separate bucket, a irrevocable trust. And that way, they won't be part of your estate for estate tax purposes. But again, you lose control of those assets. So that's a downside. Now, as Aaron mentioned, you also need to think about two things. One, the fact that this estate tax exemption amount may actually go down. And also that once you approach these levels, even if you're not above that, these levels, you may want to take some preemptive actions in anticipation of going above these estate tax levels. So that's something to think about. And it's a conversation that is related to an individual. And I also want to point out there's also state estate taxes, which have lower exemption amounts. 17 states have some sort of estate tax or inheritance tax. So that's something you have to think about if you live in one of these states as well. So this is where the conversation can get a little technical depending on an individual situation. But
I was just going to say one of the kind of easy examples is that the Tax Cut and Jobs Act that created the 11 plus million exemption is at the time of creation was slated to expire in 10 years in 2025. So if there's too much animosity and discord between political parties, that could expire and go back down to 5 million. And that's the situation where if your estate is $1 million and then you just wait 20 years, it's pretty easy. We've talked about the effect of compounding. It's pretty easy to get over that number if it doesn't increase over time.
That's right. Yeah. And if you're worried about going over with the irrevocable trust, you could move some of your assets into that irrevocable trust. And basically, that'll continue to grow. And if those assets just grow a lot from there with the help of compounding, you still don't have to worry about those assets, at least being part of your estate for estate tax purposes. And that tax is 40%, so it's a pretty heavy tax, and that's why there's all of these complicated trusts out there or different flavors of irrevocable trusts. That's estate tax, though, but for now, at least, most people don't need to worry about it as much as they used to. And that's where the other tax comes into play for a step-up in basis, which we'll get to later. But the main point is, if you don't have to worry about estate tax, a revocable trust is probably more sensible for you because it still allows you to maintain control But you get these other benefits that we mentioned about a trust, for example, avoid probate, as we had said, and you get to decide what happens with your minor children. And there are a few other benefits when you pass away where you want to have some sort of protection from creditors and things like that. So that's where a revocable trust can help.
The other thing I like to point out for couples with children especially is their life insurance benefit is income tax-free, but not necessarily estate tax-free. And we'll get into kind of what that means, but it does make a lot of sense. If you have a mortgage, if you want to make sure that your kids go to college, you want to kind of fund that amount, and then whatever your income has been, your household has lost that income. So if you have dependents, if you have a spouse and children that are dependent on your income, you definitely need to have life insurance. That life insurance benefit is not taxable in terms of income taxes, but it is possible if some combination of estate tax limit comes down, what your estate was, if it's in the, say, you have a estate of a few million dollars, and then you have life insurance, that could put you up over that exemption amount. That is possible, and you need to be aware of that. Life insurance is income tax-free, but is included in your estate for estate tax purposes. One exception to that, and again, it's just lots of caveats, and this is not going to be a kind of final recommendation for anyone. It's always consult your advisor, talk to a tax attorney, talk to a lawyer. But you can set up what's called an irrevocable life insurance trust, which is exactly what you talked about. This is a life insurance to protect beneficiaries, but because it's irrevocable, it's out of your estate. And there's lots of other rules and caveats, and you need to talk to an advisor, an attorney to set this up correctly. But in general, life insurance, which is very important, it's imperative. If you have dependents, if you have spouse and children dependent on your income, you have life insurance. That life insurance is income tax-free, but not estate tax-free.
That's a very good point. And I think it also highlights the notion that there are plenty of nuances here in terms of what might make sense for an individual rather than what generally holds for everybody.
Mm-hmm. So, couple with young children, with minor children, they need a trust. They need life insurance. Part of the trust, you said there were, what were some of the other estate planning issues for couples or even individuals with minor children?
If any of those children are special needs, well, there are certain government benefits that are awarded to individuals with special needs. But unfortunately, with a will or without a will, if you don't have a trust, you may not get protection from your assets as it relates to those government benefits. But a trust can help provide protection from those assets, still allowing the child with disabilities who's getting these benefits to still maintain those benefits if they happen to have an inheritance.
Okay, so they could continue to collect the government benefits because they are a special needs child without being forced to spend down the assets they just inherited.
Right.
If it's set up correctly.
Yeah. So basically, I think that's the key. What you said right there is you have to just set things up correctly, and you have to be proactive about how you go about these things. So that's the main key to estate planning in general. The more proactive you are, the more flexibility you will have to ensure that your estate is taking advantage of what makes the most sense at the present time.
Okay. Anything else that you talk about with young parents when they have minor children that they need to be aware of for estate planning purposes?
The main reason that I like having a firm estate plan in place is also that there's this notion of, as we talked in the beginning of this conversation, of step up in basis. And the reason I like to think about this as an estate planning feature is that it's a pretty big advantage that might get overlooked. So when you think about estate planning, you have yourself and you have your spouse and you have your kids and then you have other people. So one thing you want to understand is there are many benefits that your spouse can get from a tax perspective after you pass away, and you want to be aware of that. And that's where the step up in basis comes into play. It also comes into play when your assets pass not only from you to your spouse, but also from both you and your spouse to your children, for example. So I'd just like to throw a few numbers to give some people some context on how much of an impact this can make. Essentially, let's say you have about, by the time you pass away and you've built up a good amount of stock, we mentioned in the last episode that if you're just saving $6,000 into an IRA every year over your 20, 30, 40 year career, you can have millions of dollars in retirement in your retirement accounts. And if you're saving, let's say, just another $6,000 in a taxable account, you might have about the same. You could easily have a few million in your taxable account by just diligently saving this amount over your career. Well, let's say you have about ballpark $5 million in gains by the time you pass away. Now, typically, if the day before you die, you sold that amount and you would be taxed on that $5 million in gains. You would pay long-term capital gains rate. Hopefully, you've held it for more than a year of 20%. That's $1 million in taxes you'd pay right there. However, if you had that account in your name and you passed away, those assets would go to your wife and your wife could sell those assets immediately and not pay any taxes. Now, let me talk about the nuances on that. First, there are two types of states that people live in. This is a legal term. The first type of state is a community property state. And there are a handful of states that fit in this bucket: Arizona, California, Idaho, Louisiana, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, Washington, and Wisconsin. Now, in these states, if the husband or wife passes away, the other spouse gets the full step up in basis, meaning they get to sell that $5 million in gains and not pay anything in taxes. So that's wonderful. Now, in the case where you live in the second type of state, which is a separate property state, this is a non-community property state. This says that the husband and wife jointly own all property if it's in both of their names. That means if the husband and the wife, if either passes away, you'll have to pay 50% of the money that you would have saved in a community property state. So instead of paying $1 million in tax if you sold it before you die, or instead of paying zero in tax in a community property state, if you live in a separate property state, which is most states, you will have to pay $500,000 in tax.
Okay, so separate property states, they get kind of a half step up in basis, or a step up in basis for half of the shares, or
right,
however you want to think about it. But for community property state, the first spouse to pass away, the first inheriting spouse gets a full step from basis. And then when the second spouse passes away, the children or heirs or beneficiaries also get a step up in basis.
Yeah, that's right. So let's say nothing happens and both parents pass away. Well, then the children would save that $1 million in tax burden, and regardless of where they lived in any state.
Yes, now, but if there's time in between the two deaths, so if it's a $5 million estate, one spouse passes away, there's a step up in basis, and then it grows to $6 million, and then the second spouse passes away, the beneficiaries, they get the full step up in basis at that second time also. So the first spouse would not own any capital gains, and the beneficiaries would not own capital gains. Where they separate property state, the first spouse only gets a half step up in basis. It's not until the death of the second spouse that the beneficiaries get that full step up in basis. And what that also means is, and I want to double check with you, with a separate property state, if the there's a step-up basis upon the first death. Any growth from there, do the beneficiaries, do the children get a step-up basis on that first half? Do you know?
Here's where things get a little bit tricky. So before I get into that specific situation, I want to explain one other nuance that's happening here. So thing one, though, if you want to save that full $1 million that you might pay in taxes, move to a community property state before you pass away. So not everybody has that luxury. So if you do live in a separate property state, there are still a few things you can do to actually potentially get that full $1 million in tax savings benefit when one spouse passes away. Now, the way this works is for joint assets, you get that 50% step up in basis. However, if the assets are in the person who passes away's name, then the surviving spouse will also get a full step up in basis on those assets. So that's a bit of a nuance, but the way this somebody might think about this is, let's say all of the assets were put in the husband's name, and then the husband passed away. So now the wife would get that full $1 million in tax savings instead of that 50% if those assets were in a joint account. Now, the tricky part here is you don't really know which spouse is going to pass away first. However, you know, if one spouse does become terminal for a reason, it might make sense to do some of the shuffling in advance. Now, the thing is, you have to do this 1 year in advance at least for you to obtain this tax benefit. And of course, this is talking about the rules today and things can change, but that's something to be aware of because $1 million is a lot of money. So that took quite some time too.
Is it only 1 year?
The boomerang rule? I believe so. I believe it's 1 year.
I thought it was 3 years, at least for maybe federal.
We can double check and add that to the show notes, but that's okay. The latest I heard from a CPA. Okay. But of course, this all should be run by a CPA as well. That's definitely what we recommend for these types of strategies. So lawyer, CPA, financial planner.
Yeah.
Now, okay. The thing with this type of scenario is, again, you have to anticipate a bit and you have to move assets in the right name. But there is some potential savings to be had. But then also, to be clear, when both husband and wife pass away, then you do get this full step up in basis after that on the total accounts. Now, you have to shift accounts from the husband to the wife accordingly. Say if the husband passes away first with this rule called portability, and in order to ensure that those combined assets, the husband and the wife, don't breach that currently $23 million estate planning tax limit. So that's something to think about as well. Because just because you have, you know, $5 million in gains today doesn't mean that over the next 20 or 30 years, should the wife live longer, that the total estate can't grow above that current estate tax cutoff.
Yeah. And like we said before, the estate tax exemption could come down and your $5 million could already be over.
That's true too. Yeah. So there's a bunch of nuances to think about there. And I just want to throw in a few more high level things. The other is when you think about estate tax, there's two things that are going on. There's the taxes at the federal estate tax level and the estate tax level at the state level. And then that's for the people who are passed away, but the people obtaining the money, well, then there might be a separate tax for that. That's known as the inheritance tax. So that's something to think about as well. Now, at the federal level, currently there is zero inheritance tax, but at the state level, there is an inheritance tax in 6 states, in fact. So that's something to think about as well. And this is where some planning can help.
Okay. Anything else? So maybe not necessarily related to having children. You had mentioned the healthcare directives, and what are some of the parts of the estate plan that just make sense for everyone, independent of whether they have minor children or not?
Right. So another thing to think about is this notion of gifting and gift tax. So the way gifting comes into play with an estate in general is you're allowed to gift a certain amount each year to anybody without having that gifted amount be subject to your limit for estate tax purposes, or your overall exemption amount. And that amount is $15,000 a year. And that sounds small, and it's, you know, often gets overlooked if you have, you know, let's say a couple million dollars in your estate, but it can be pretty significant over time if you think about it. For example, your spouse can also give $15,000. So if you have one kid, that's 15 times 15, that's $30,000 a year, not bad. You can also gift to your son or daughter's spouse. So you can double that. So your 30 goes to 60,000 a year. So that could be quite a bit. But you can also, if your child has a child themselves, you can gift to your grandchildren. So if your child has two kids, well, now you can gift to each. So you can see how you could potentially be gifting 100, 200,000 a year, depending on how many kids and grandkids you have, without having to have that amount be subject to a gift tax.
Okay. And what happens if they want to go over that 15 from person to person, that 15,000 per year?
There is a few other things to think about. I believe there's the 5-year rule with gifting. And also there are other payments that you can make that are not subject to gift tax. For example, you can make unlimited payments for an individual's medical or tuition. Now, mm-hmm. The tricky part there is you have to make it directly to the hospital or directly to the education institution. You can't cut the person a check and they, you know, write the check to the hospital and whatnot. But that you can also do. So that's a good way to transfer money because, as we've talked about, healthcare and education bills are exorbitant.
So could you explain the lifetime exemption and how that relates to gifting and the estate tax?
Yeah, I'd be happy to dig into that. Do you happen to have the cutoff for the gift tax?
So the gift tax on an annual basis is that $15,000 per year, and it does go Congress tries to let it go up each year, but I know they've done a pretty good job of lining up the lifetime exemption for gifting with the estate tax exemption. The idea there is if you know you're passing away, and let's say you have an estate that's currently $15 million, and the exemption, and you're single, the estate tax exemption is 11. They want it to be the same as if you gave all your money the day before you died and the day after you died. So they're going to apply the same lifetime gift tax exemption as they would the estate tax exemption. And so now if you go over that annual exemption, that $15,000, it goes against your lifetime exemption. And so let's say the exemption stays at $11 million and your total estate is $15 million and it keeps growing enough to pay out your $60,000 example. You're single, so you're paying out $30,000 to a child and spouse, but kind of independent of that annual amount, if I was to give them $1 million, that reduces, I can give them up to that $11 million without paying any gift taxes in that particular year. I can choose not to, but when I pass away, I've used up that lifetime exemption. So if I give away up $10 million and I pass away, I only have $1 million estate tax exemption left. So there's a lifetime gift tax exemption that's tied to the estate tax exemption. So any gifts over the annual exemption go against your lifetime exemption, which in general is going to be the same number as the estate tax exemption.
Yeah. And the other thing to remember is if you're going to be doing this, you're going to have to be tracking this over all these years that, you know, you've gone over the 15K in this year by this amount and so on. So that you also create a good amount of paperwork to think about.
Oh, there's, it requires a ton of tracking, especially as the lifetime exemption and estate tax exemption go up over time and change, then you could, I honestly, this is what I'm going to defer to a CPA. I don't quite know, but I do know as the estate tax exemption has been going up and lifetime exemption is going up, you can gift more and more of your estate and kind of use up that next amount. So when it went from 3 million to 5 million, if you had already gifted 3 million's worth and used up your exemption, you could now gift another 2 million to get up to the new 5 million. I don't know what's going to happen if you gift $11 million, use up your lifetime gift tax exemption, and then the estate tax exemption comes back down to five. I think the IRS will consider that has already been gifted at and as the law at the time. So I think that's grandfathered in, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, it's one of those gray areas that we just have to keep in the back of our minds as we're going through this process. Essentially, as we had said, you know, from the 90s until now, it's just kind of gone up. So
yeah,
we're at a point where where it's going to be a little tricky, but it'll certainly keep a lot of professionals busy once this changes again, which it surely will.
Yep. If it keeps going up, not really a concern. If it goes down, it's like almost like that meme of eating the popcorn, just watching to see what's happening.
Yeah. So we can't keep going up forever, maybe. But the other thing to realize is millions of people pass away every year. And so far now, the estate tax affects maybe 1,000, 2,000 of people a year out of those 2 million to 3 million that pass away in a given year. So right now, it's really a tax that doesn't affect almost anybody.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That the things like the trust, life insurance are more important. The gifting and the lifetime exemption and the estate tax exemption are significantly less likely to come into play. But like you said, the step-up in basis and the difference between community property and separate property, that is likely to affect a large number of people. You used an extreme example. But even if you use just a small example, if your estate is $1 million, but you have a $200,000 unrealized gain, that step up in basis could be saving you, like you said, 20% of that $200,000 gain could be saving you $40,000 in taxes. And that is something that does apply to a wide variety of people. And that comes into that decision of, do I use a traditional IRA or a taxable investment account? It's not the primary thing, but it's big enough to be a factor that you want to be aware of when looking down the road.
Yeah. And the last thing I want to highlight is we had mentioned before that with IRAs, if those IRAs do pass on to a heir, well, those heirs in the past, they used to be able to stretch those redemptions from the IRA over their lifetime according to a RMD schedule where basically you could take out a few percent every year and let that go on to your lifetime. So that used to be a great way to pass on money from yourself to your heirs because you have this IRA, it's tax advantage, and you don't have to spend it all. It can continue to grow over your heir's lifetime. But based upon changes in the Secure Act this year, that has been changed so that your heirs must spend all of that or take out all of that money from the tax advantage account by a 10-year period, whether it's a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA. So that's a pretty big change, but something to be aware of And that basically just puts more emphasis on the fact that maybe there's other ways to handle moving assets from your estate beyond just your retirement account.
Mm-hmm. And I like to point out it has to be taken out within 10 years. It does not have to be taken out in the first few years. You can actually wait until year 10 for any distributions. And this gives you an opportunity to kind of strategically plan when you're going to take it out, because all of that money from a traditional IRA will be added to your taxable income. Instead of pushing you up into a higher tax bracket and paying a higher marginal tax rate, if you can wait for a year that you either know or end up having a lower income, that might be a good year to opportunistically take all the money out of the traditional IRA. But with the Roths, because the Roth is all after-tax dollars anyways, the taxes have already been paid. Whenever you take that money out, the beneficiaries and the heirs, that is all tax-free to them. So many, many times a Roth can actually be a great estate planning vehicle with money that you may or may not need in your own lifetime, but you want to see grow, because you get the benefits of the tax deferral, but also it's going to be income tax-free to your heirs.
Yeah, and in that case, why not just wait that full 10 years for the heirs and then take it out, if possible?
Yeah, I probably agree. The benefits of the tax deferral over those 10 years would probably outweigh whatever you would put it in if you were to take the money out. Yeah, that's a good point. If you inherit a Roth IRA, it most likely makes sense to leave it as an inherited Roth IRA as long as you can.
Right, for sure. So, you know, overall, plenty to think about when it comes to an estate plan, whether you're young, you know, or even nearing retirement. It's just getting your ducks in a row so that A, things get done how you wish, but B, you can save yourself some money as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing to point out. There's so many nuances and complexities that are unique to each individual situation. The state that you live in matters a great deal. Your family structure matters. Like what your actual desires are. Do you want to leave money to a niece or nephew? Because under the normal inheritance process, if you don't have those instructions, even if you write it in a will, the courts may not follow that. That might say, no, this money needs to go to your children, or if you want to leave it to a sibling. So much of it is just that planning in advance, because once you pass away, there's no changes that can be made at that point.
Yeah. So good stuff, Aaron. I really enjoyed today's conversation.
I did too. It may not have been any concrete advice for anyone, but I think there's enough things there that they're starting to look and see how different things might apply to their situation. So again, thank you, Tricia, for really leading today's conversation and providing so much information.
Well, good stuff. And I enjoyed it as well. And thanks everybody for listening. If you enjoy these conversations, we'd love to have some feedback, and do leave a review. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical, as no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.